Hello, and welcome to another episode of Waves of Change, a Great Lakes Now digital series focused on highlighting the diverse voices and perspectives shaping the environmental justice movement throughout the Great Lakes region. I'm Anna Seisling, and I'm so grateful to you for tuning in.
This program was brought to you by the Fred and Barbara Earp Family Foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Richard C. Devereaux Foundation for Energy and Environmental Programs at Detroit PBS, Polk Family Fund, DTE Foundation, and contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Joining me today is Antonio Cosme. Antonio is an Indigenous descended creative, organizer, and educator from Southwest Detroit, whose current work spans conservation, environmental justice, and traditional ecological activities. He works with the grassroots nonprofit Black to the Land as an organizer and as the land stewardship manager for Friends of Rouge Park. Antonio, I'm so happy to be in conversation with you today.
Yeah, happy to be here too.
As we find ourselves in the final days, really, of 2024, how's the season finding you as a person who I know is really deeply connected to seasonality?
You know, I'm having a wonderful time. I spent a lot of time. I just got back from traveling around the northern Great Lakes area. I was up in Lac des Flambeaux visiting a buddy, Greg Johnson up there, Biscocanay Greg Johnson, and I got to help him do some moccasin making classes at UW-Madison and at this place called North House Folk School. And it's always really wonderful to get out of the city and to experience winter in a bigger way, to go up north where there's more snow and more forests. So I'm feeling really full at the moment.
When we spoke prior to recording this interview, you told me that your work is really about a confluence of environmental justice, traditional ecological practices, and conservation. And I think this really speaks to a holistic approach that you have in thinking about each of these things. So what does integrating these things look like in daily practice for you?
I would say that my work very much so follows the seasons and changes with the time of the year that it's in. Right now is a time for planning. It's a time for storytelling. It's a time for writing grants. It's a time for enjoying the abundance that we've harvested throughout the entire year. I'd say like the next season I'm preparing for, the next big activity is hunting. I'm leading a hunting camp that's sponsored. The DNR is paying for it. It's through Black to Land and this other nonprofit called Our Global Kids. And we're going to be taking, I think it's 15 people hunting up in northern Michigan in Gladwin. And I'm super excited about that. And that's, I think, where the sort of merger of indigenous and conservation comes in some ways. Because I think conservation is more about sports hunting and using the money from that sort of activity to fund the protection of land and nature. And then for me, like as an urban person, trying to get people of color outdoors, we are more on the subsistence interest in hunting. And then using the entire animal. So using the bones to make bone broth. I was harvesting a bunch of sinew last night from some deer I harvested up north to make string that I'll be using for other projects, so particularly sewing projects. So yeah, I think bridging that gap between urban communities and these rural areas and rural lifestyles and rural habits, I think is an important part of that work. I mean, for so many reasons. But yeah, I think that's what it looks like as an example.
And now, Antonio, I want to ask you a little bit about the term environmental justice. I know this is a loaded phrase, and it's something that's really central to this series, Waves of Change. I wonder what that idea and term means to you.
As somebody who's been working in environmental justice for maybe almost 10 years, my work really began with trying to stop the water shutoffs in Detroit. And that was really what opened my eyes, the fact that my water was shut off, my neighbor's water was getting shut off, this pregnant woman on my block's water was getting shut off. That really opened my eyes to environmental justice work. I'm like maybe 2 miles north of Zug Island, which is a super polluted area. I'm a couple miles away from 48217, which is a super polluted zip code in Detroit. So I had an awareness of these places, but I didn't understand the nature of environmental racism. In the ways in which often poor and people of color communities tend to live in areas that are super environmentally degraded. And I think that's what standard environmental justice is focused on. And for me, I think that's a very limited way to understand the possibility of what environmental justice could look like. And it's inclusive of voices that are super marginalized, but it's not inclusive of the majority of the country. And I think in order to like advance something, everybody's got to have a stake in it. Everybody's got to see themselves in that movement. So for me, not including agriculture in environmental justice, not including the way we manage forests in environmental justice, not including the ways in which the primary ecological interruptions of colonialism and capitalism have destroyed and displaced indigenous land-based systems in environmental justice is like a mistake. It's a fundamental error in focus and scope that I think limits the conversation and limits the capacity of the coalition to grow.
Talking a little bit about your background and the fact that you are based in Southwest Detroit, but like you said before, you regularly spend time in more rural areas. What first got you motivated to take that leap to kind of build bridges between what you saw around environmental injustice and getting more communities of color to feel safe, empowered, and excited about being outside?
It's in everybody's blood, ultimately. Everybody's roots, everybody's ancestry. If you dig far back enough in the tree, you're going to find farmers, you're going to find campesinos, you're going to find rural people, you're going to find people who were toiling in the soil. Just got to go back and the trees get bigger every generation. So you'll find some people. Eventually, you'll find some native people who spoke different languages from different cultures, who are more rooted in a particular ecosystem, whose languages evolved to describe that particular place. But for me, like, my grandma's from the hills of Puerto Rico, and the word is jíbaro. Jíbaro is like hillbilly, but it's a more affectionate term because when Puerto Rico was being colonized, the hills are where the people could survive. The hills is where you could remain independent. The hills is where you could have a farm because the valleys were taken. The valleys were great for sugarcane, great for other crops, but the hills were places that were, you know, less ravaged by agriculture, more people could survive and thrive. So it has this like sort of sovereignty element. So jíbaro is like my grandma would take us to all of these metro parks around Detroit. And she's the kind of lady that was like off the trails, in the rivers, catching crayfish, grabbing plants, taking them home, collecting seeds. And she just did this. And she kept like a little cornucopia of whatever, like in her garden. She'd plant stuff. She was just like a very verdant sort of green thumb sort of woman. So growing up under her, and then my mom always had a garden. So that's compelling to nature. We always went camping every summer as a family too. Like it was like a big thing in our Puerto Rican family. We'd go up north and paddle the Asabo River. But what compels me into the work around conservation and stewardship work, I would say I was getting burnt out by social justice work. My background's actually in economics is like what really a big underpinning for my understanding and analysis of this world and history and trends and systems. I was kind of burnt out on activism work. You know, my family had lost our home in the 2008 financial crisis. And I kind of switched to economics in order to understand these systems better. A lot of times we understand like functionally what's happening in the hood, but we don't necessarily have the words to describe the structures and the systems, the superstructures that are impacting us. So putting words to all that was like my original like kind of work when I moved back to Detroit, and Detroit was going through its like aggressive emergency management bankruptcy process. But when that was happening, like we were throwing down, doing civil disobedience, like fighting the man and interrupting things, and we lost, you know, like the emergency manager fights rapidly turned into the water shutoff fight, and we lost that fight too. Not being successful in this endeavors as a young person kind of was frustrating. So I kind of took to the walls. I was doing graffiti and painting, and I got busted for doing graffiti, painting Free the Water on a water tower in 2015 or 16. And that like really kind of got me thinking a lot more about the work that I was doing, how sustainable it was, like what it meant to be throwing my life energy into fighting back and resisting. And I realized that it's more important to focus on positive alternatives, at least have some of that work. Like I still participate in protest politics on occasion, but I will definitely like ground myself in work that I find inspiring, work that I find meaningful, work that I don't think is being done. I took to what I grew up doing, camping and gardening, and one thing led to another. I had already made all these inroads with the indigenous community through my part of this hip hop and art collective called the Rise Up, and that really introduced me to the native community around the Great Lakes. And then I went to this thing called the Intertribal Food Summit, where I was able to meet all of these like producers, people who, hunt, fish, grow food, and building into those networks and connecting with those people has like opened up, like the world of like Anishinaabe country around the Great Lakes.
There is so much in what you just said that sounds like real stepping stones in your sort of professional trajectory. And I want to talk a little bit about where you're at now. Can you tell me about Friends of the Rouge Park and the work that you're doing there?
So Rouge Park is the city's largest urban park. It's 1,200 acres, 700 acres of forest that are mostly floodplain valley. We have like a 100-acre prairie, and a lot of social and athletic activities throughout the park. And I kind of got connected to them through the Sugarbush Project, where we were tapping maple trees in Rouge Park. But that work looks all sorts of different ways all the time. I get to like take people outdoors and host bonfires, and I come up with gimmicks to get people to, get outdoors and in touch with nature. So I have a lot of
Cool.
different little ways to do it.
And then there's the work that you do with Black to the Land. This is a group that started out as a coalition but has evolved. Tell me a little bit about what's happening with that.
So we started off as just a bunch of families who wanted to get outdoors and connect with nature, and so yeah, we would wanted to go to the UP, and it's pretty far, so we'd form a big group of people, a lot of single mothers and some families, and we'd drive up to the Upper Peninsula and just kind of enjoy ourselves in nature. And that's how it started off, is just a it's kind of like bubbled out of this food justice, culturally centered and culturally rooted. So like a lot of it's African. Detroit's the blackest major city in the country, which is why it's called Black to the Land, but it's really like a BIPOC organization. It's really about getting people of color connected with nature. And we just have grown and grown every year for the last 5 years, taking on different tasks. It did start as a coalition because all of us were part of different organizations and we just started working together, but we morphed into like a nonprofit organization, and we're actually redeveloping the coalition again with this initiative called Black and Brown and Green, which is a network gathering for people who work in conservation, environmental justice, sustainability, agriculture, outdoors, parks, whatever. If you identify as a person of color who works in green, Black and Brown and Green is a great place to come and meet other people and network. So we are reviving the coalition aspect again. But yeah, the work parallels a lot of the work in Rouge Park. So like I'm full time doing seasonal outdoor nature activities. With Black to Land, we paddle, hunt, fish, forage, hike, backpack. Trail running we just added recently. So we do a lot of like outdoor nature activities that happen all year long.
So I kind of want to ask you now, Antonio, a little bit about both the youth education and outreach component to this work, but also what I imagine is probably equal parts adult education and outreach as well. Can you talk a little bit about creating a sense of accessibility and safety when you are inviting people into doing some of these activities that may feel familiar to you, but might be like totally out of someone else's comfort zone?
Yeah, this liability and safety pieces are becoming increasingly important to us as we're serving more and more people who have, less connection with nature. So for instance, I'll just like talk about the paddling because that's a wonderful example of something that people may not be comfortable doing, haven't had much experience with, and offers a slight risk of danger depending on how you do the activity. So we've been getting trained up through the American Canoe Association and the British kayaker. I forget the name of the group, but there's another organization that's a kind of like a sister org to us called Chicago Adventure Therapy, and they've been like kind of connecting us with all of these kayaking symposiums, and we've been sending people to get training on how to rescue people, how to educate people, how to lead people in the water. We've been learning by trial and error, honestly. Like I'm glad we've never had anybody get drowned or injured. But we were just like taking people on the water paddling and canoeing, and we didn't necessarily know how to pull a boat that gets waterlogged out or the best way to rescue people. So we've been gathering those skills. Now we have a team of like 6 to 10 people who all are competently could pull a canoe out of the water or kayak out of the water if somebody spilled over. They could go to them, direct them. It's also just the simple things, making sure people are wearing life vests and making sure they try and pull up on the life vest so it fits them, that they button up everything so that it doesn't come off when they're in the water. It's also just about effectively communicating with people so that they know what to expect and know how to behave when given challenges come towards them. So proper facilitation and communication are really, really important keys to taking people out into nature in a safe and effective way.
I think as I deepen my own journey and understanding of different ways to engage with and recreate in the natural world, I'm really struck by how certain sports, like mountain biking, for instance, like there's a major financial barrier there. Yeah. So I wonder, you mentioned the winter kind of being a season where you're writing grants and thinking about things. Can you talk a little bit just about the financial accessibility piece of this and totally. How to go about not only getting people to like give you that kind of buy-in in terms of their attention and enthusiasm, but also like what is the kind of like financial component to all of this?
Winter sports are expensive, but we still have people participating in winter sports. For me, I start with what is cheap and free and available always. Like, so we do sledding days. Anytime there's a decent snowfall, we organize kind of an impromptu sledding day. We bought a bunch of sleds, so we have those. People just need to get there, and they have to have the winter clothes to do it. So I often bring containers full of winter clothes to supplement what people don't have. So gloves and pants and sort of things. And this material and this gloves and clothes comes from this broader thing called the gear library. And we share a gear library and equipment library with Detroit Outdoors, which is another, it's a collaborative that's becoming a nonprofit organization. But we share a gear library with them that has a lot of the equipment and tools that we need. But we also partner with other organizations. So there's this organization called SOS Detroit. Or it's SOS, it's a national organization that helps get people skiing and doing downhill stuff outdoors. There's another organization called Jim Dandy, which is the oldest black ski club in the country, and it's based in Detroit. So we just tap into existing resources and people who have experience and know what they're doing, and we just try and plug more people into those organizations. We don't have to do everything. We don't have to like continually reinvent the wheel. There are like educational programs at like Mount Brighton, for instance, where we get discounts because of various partnerships. So it's really just like tapping into the networks and finding ways to do it. We also like get grant money to fund different opportunities. Like last year, we took a bunch of people cross-country skiing, and that was paid for through a grant through Fish and Wildlife. So we look for like different grant monies to open up opportunities to get people to engage in nature. Like all seasons. Like I said, we are like, it's kind of this like lull before winter sports and activities start because there's not much snow in Detroit. Tends not to be. But yeah, we participate in these sort of expensive winter outdoor activities as well. You know, it just modulates who can come, how open it can be, just depending on the funding and the partnerships we have in place.
Just the relational aspect and the community aspect in this work is so apparent and has really been a part of, I think, every single thing that you have said in this conversation today. And that makes me want to ask you a little bit about your lineage in arriving to this work. You also mentioned your grandma a little bit earlier. Talk to me a little bit about not only the people that you're working alongside, but also the people that you have learn some really valuable lessons from along the way and how that shapes or informs the way that you're showing up to this work.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it starts with my parents. Like, I was like the richest of poor people or like the poorest of the middle class. I'm not sure, somewhere in there. But, you know, I was working class family. My dad was a welder, a union welder growing up. And my parents were just like heavily civically engaged in the communities around our K-8 experience. They coached us in softball and basketball, and president of the PTA, athletic director, on the board for the church and parochial communities we were part of. So I just grew up in a household where the public good and serving your community just came intrinsically in what we did every day as a family. There are so many people who have been touched by my father, like, just through him coaching and being athletic director for years and years and years. People just remember, you know, he made an impact on so many people's lives. And I was the kid in the baseball field chasing bugs. You know, like my brother was the athlete. He's a little older than me. I'm the middle child. And I was just like interested in nature and interested in the critters more than I was the games at hand. So I would say like a big part of it was just my family for sure. I'm just inspired by so many people all the time. Like I feel a lot of compersion throughout, like as I explore and get to know communities and see what's going on, compersion being like the opposite of like jealousy of people who are doing something you love. Like it's just that feeling of gratitude and joy in seeing somebody thrive and be passionate about their work. And I've always just I've always wanted to do stuff I cared about. You know, I've had to work a couple jobs I didn't care about in my life, and I don't know what's a life full of that. You know, I don't know. Pursuing my passions and interests with other people is a really important to me. And I guess lastly, I think there's something super human that many of us, I think, are missing in the modern nuclear family ways in which we move about society. Doing stuff together for a broader purpose as a group is like one of the best feelings in the world. Like, I love what I call like a collective effervescence. It's just like the joy and interconnection of a bunch of people working on a project. Like, I love that. So I often am, I feel like searching for that and facilitating that and finding places where it's happening and going to those places and just working with people. And outdoors happens to be one of my favorite places to do it.
I kind of want to go back now, Antonio, to asking you a little bit about these hunting camps that you touched on earlier. So this is not only a way, I think, for folks to come into really deep connection with the more than human world, really, but I think it's also a really valuable way to break down what feels like a really built up systemic rural urban divides. Can you talk to me a little bit about the role that hunting plays in kind of breaking down some of those barriers?
Yeah, I always hear people talk about like civil war or like after this election, like blue versus red, like MAGA or whatever centers of the city. And you see like the vote tends to be that way. But I don't think people are naturally that way. And I don't think our interests are so different all the time when it comes to every issue. And nature is a place that I think we can all agree on and can all go to and can all connect with. But it's just harder for city people. The distance is harder. We don't, it's just not part of the culture in the city to like close up shop during this time of year to get ready for hunting, to take time off, to have the clothes, to have access to the land, to have access to the resources. So we're trying to help bridge that divide and bridge that gap and close that for people so that they can gain access to private land, so they can go to places, so they can appreciate and grow those skills. And yeah, hunting is such a visceral way to connect with this time of year. It's a way to feed your family. It's a way to be outdoors. And there's something so special about sitting up in a blind when it's dark outside and watching the forest come alive and the sun come up and the birds come out and the squirrels. And then if you're lucky, a deer. And then you like do your best to take the most ethical shot and process the deer. And it's just a really rich sort of opportunity experience that I think a lot of people in the city don't have to be connected with their food and be connected with nature in that way. So we're working hard through this collaboration with the DNR to do a hunting camp. This is the first year we've done anything like this. Previously, we've just been small little hunts with hunters that we know in our network and our friends. And it's been cool, but we really want to like increase the capacity among Detroiters. You know, a lot of Detroiters have rifles, a lot of Detroiters have guns, but getting them to learn hunter safety skills, getting them to feel comfortable getting out there, getting them to wear the right clothes and know the rules and regulations so they don't get in trouble. All of those things are super important to making sure people have safe experiences hunting and being outdoors. So we're trying to facilitate that, and we're learning a lot, you know, as we're doing these things. So yeah, in terms of like the divide piece, I think I'm excited to see what that looks like in the future. You know, it's such a new area for us, and Black2Land largely serves like people of color. But you know, we're looking to develop a program next year where we offer people the opportunity to give us access to their land so that people in our network, people who we know who've gone through hunter safety, people we know who like are proficient with the gun and can get out there and use that private land. Because the public land in and around and close to the city is really used and full, and you run into challenges with people who've been there for years and years with their hunter stand. So we want to avoid those, and getting access to farms and getting access to private land is a way we want to do that. So I think that's that'll be an opportunity for people to engage with each other. We also want to engage some of these like rural Black communities that exist, because it's super important for anybody who's learning to see themselves in people who are competent with those skills. So it's like not like we're focused on segregating ourselves into people, only people of color outdoors. Like, it's so many studies indicate that when the teacher, the professor, the person you're learning from looks like you, or and you're learning in a community of your own people, like you just tend to do better and to focus on it more and see the possibilities of it being something that belongs to you, that you're a part of. And that sense of belonging is so, so, so crucial to getting people to commit to a change in lifestyle.
What are some of like the biggest obstacles or challenges in this work, in this moment for you?
Competent leaders to walk with and to work with that are part of our community. So I'd say that's one. Another one is like funding, distance, you know, to these places. So like tapping into what exists in the city, like I would love it if the city would open us up a hunting season. If we do archery in the city, like that'd be fantastic, because that would shorten the gap. We could be in Detroit. In Rouge Park, there's a big issue with overpopulation of deer. Like there used to be a lot of trillium flowers. They don't even exist hardly in the park anymore because these deer are so overpopulated. So we're working with the city to hopefully encourage them to either like start a deer call program and work with the USDA to do that. That's one way. Another way is just tapping into the citizenry and ensuring that they have the skills. And that'd be a wonderful way to connect people with nature and the seasons and this conservation activity. I mean, hunting plays such an important role in what funds the management of lands and places all over the state. And the state itself has been increasingly concerned about less and less people being interested in hunting. So urban communities are a wonderful space for the state to grow that pool of hunters. And, you know, we're here to serve that need on all parts. Even though I have a lot of problems with the conservation model, I think it's where we're at now, and getting our people engaged in it is a wonderful way to bridge that gap.
In the very beginning of this conversation, you mentioned the moccasin workshop. I wonder if there's anything else that has either been a recent source of joy or something that as the season progresses, you are really finding yourself looking forward to.
Using the entire deer has been something that's been really important to me as somebody who's hunting, as somebody who wants to be doing it in a different way. It's really time intensive to process everything down to the knuckles on the deer. I mean, people throw this stuff away, and it's fine to do so. Like, it feeds nature, it feeds the coyotes, it feeds the eagles. But yeah, for me, like, I want to use the entire deer. So I've been like saving hides, and I've been attending workshops on how to brain tan the leather. And it's just so, it smells so wonderful. It feels so wonderful. It's such a beautiful ancient process. You have to like soak them in like water soluble fats, like egg yolk or brain. There's just so much wonderful to it. And in the time where everything is synthetic and fake and AI and digital, just to like make your own leather and then like sew it into some moccasins feels like a kind of a revolutionary like ancient technology. And I think as a society, we've become such a consumer society, and we've gone away from producing and gone away from making and gone away from the sort of pride that comes in that craftsmanship and that ownership and that joy and creativity that you could put into something that you make yourself. So yeah, I think I've really, really enjoyed delving into moccasin making, and I'm interested in learning how to make other things with leather. But yeah, making brain tan leather is something I really want to bring to the city.
You know, I'm not at all surprised to find you describing the process to be really grounding and nourishing. I am surprised, though, that you said it smells good. I didn't expect that.
Well, There's two ways to do it. Like, you could do it with the rotten way, where you allow the hide to rot, which allows the you to, like, the dermal layers and the hair to come off a lot easier. Or you could use, like, a bucking solution. There's a lot of ways to do it. But if you do it with avoid the rotting way, like, it smells wonderful. Oh, it's like a campfire.
Wow. Okay. Learning new things like every 5 seconds in this.
Yeah, I mean, most leather we experience is like super pollution. Like, I mean, it's like full of chromium and all sorts of really nasty things you wouldn't even want on your body. So doing this buckskin sort of stuff is, it feels pretty exciting.
Wow. That's really, really cool. I wonder, as we close out the conversation, Antonio, if there are any like links or resources that you want to share out with people who want to find ways to help support the work that you are continuing to do. And if there are any other really rad people or organizations that you want to make sure you mention for folks to also learn more about.
Oh man, there's so many that come to mind, honestly. But if you want to support Black to the Land, you can check us out on our Instagram. We also have a website, blacktolandcoalition.com or .org. But just Google Black to the Land Coalition, you'll find us. You can donate, and that's always helpful. If you want to like donate gear and equipment, you can reach out to us via email, blacktolandcoalition@gmail.com. If you're a landowner who wants to engage with Black to the Land, please be on the lookout for the Green Book program we're going to be developing soon. Yeah, as far as Friends of Rouge Park, there's also like Friends of Rouge Park is the org, but you could just check out Detroit Rouge Park and you'll find that information. You could volunteer in our stewardship days. There's a link tree in our Instagram profile and on our website where you could sign up and volunteer, and you get text messages and stuff like that to stay engaged with that sort of work. As far as like great work happening, it's happening all over the place. I would say anybody who's looking to tap in, like, find your local watershed organization, like, because there's a lot of amazing work happening in your watershed. But for us, the Friends of Rouge as a watershed organization, the Detroit Parks Coalition, the Michigan Environmental Justice Counts Coalition, Detroit Urban Forest Schools, we have a program with Black to Land where it's like a way for kids who are 5 to 12 to get outdoors. They have like two events a month. Detroit Outdoors, fantastic collaboration. The Detroit Bird Alliance, formerly the Audubon, they changed the name for obvious reasons. BIPOC Birders is another fantastic organization. We're Fixing a Fish is a great organization. The Michigan Natural Features Inventory is another fantastic organization. If you're interested in vernal pond monitoring or frog monitoring, they also do some like rattlesnake hunts and searches. Friends of the Detroit River is a new organization we started collaborating with this year. I definitely shout out Chicago Adventure Therapy, the Belle Isle Conservancy. We got some native people on their board recently. Excited to see what comes of that. MSU Detroit Center, there's this place called the DP Fly. They're a wonderful partner in a lot of organizations. Brightmoor Artisan Collective has opened up their kitchen to us at different times. Shout out to the tribal communities who have supported us. Jerry Jondro and the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community, Lac de Flambeau, Greg Johnson, Pokagon, Band of Potawatomi, Jefferson, Baloo. And there's so many other creators, like intertribal folks. Alkibalan Village is another organization we partner with a lot for different things. D-Town Farms, the Detroit Black Food Security Network, Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. Such a mouthful. But they have that cooperative grocery store that just opened in Detroit. Go check that out if you want to tap into wonderful community. We've been recently partnering a lot with the Michigan National Wild Turkey Federation, and they've been super wonderful partners in our hunter safety work, partnering with the DNR, our Global Kids for the hunting work. And there's a whole bunch more that I just, you know, don't want to like list them all and keep the list going too long, but there are so many people doing fantastic work all over the place. You just got to like go and find them and tap in.
All right. Well, Antonio Cosme, thank you so much for all of your time, your enthusiasm, your care, your attention, and your expertise. I'm really, really grateful for this conversation.
Yeah, me too.
Waves of Change is a production of Great Lakes Now and Detroit PBS. This digital series is produced and edited by me, Anna Seisling, with additional support from Jordan Wingrove. Great Lakes Now's executive producer is Rob Green, and Detroit PBS Vice President of Content is Ed Moore.
This program was brought to you by the Fred and Barbara Earp Family Foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Richard C. Devereaux Foundation for Energy and Environmental Programs at Detroit PBS, Polk Family Fund, D. DTE Foundation, and contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.